Gentlemen, welcome again. We meet this week as usual, of course. We are here. Next week is the Lucy Davidovich lecture. Professor Marjorie Lehman will be delivering that. And I urge you all to come. It should be very interesting, very worthwhile. And so that will be instead of this class. That's same time, not same place though, down in the shul, for the Lucy Davidovich lecture. And then the following week will be the last of the classes that I will teach. After I have concluded, and that both will think over after that. So we just keep going and going and going. We are on Daf Lamed Chet Amud Aleph 38A3. We are once again in this section of the chapter, the latter part of chapter 4, which is filled with Agadah, filled with Agadah. And as you've already seen, some of the Agadot that you kind of heard about, you see that they're all from this latter part of chapter 4, you'll continue to see that, because some of the grandest Agadot that we have on the end of chapter 4 of Masechet Sanhedrin. We're on the right side of the page, 38A3, the right side of the English translation, Tanu Rabbanan. Our rabbis taught. Adam nivra be'erev Shabbat, shelo yuhut stukim umipneima, shelo yuhut stukim omrim, shutaf haya lo la'kadosh baruch hu b'maaseh bereshit. The human being, this is a baraita, the human being was created, I translate Adam as a human being, nivra was created on Erev Shabbat. And of course, the human being was created in the sixth day, in the latter part of the sixth day. Okay? The animals are created also on the sixth day. The mammals are created then. But the human being is created after that. So he's created Erev Shabbat, last thing, before the Shabbat. So the Gemara says, why was he created then? Could be created any time. Why save him for that spot? Shelo yuhut stukim omrim. So that the Sadducees not say, and here you see in English it says heretics. I honestly think that this is probably the result of the censor. The censor changed this to Sadducees. If you look in the Rashi, for example, Rashi has Shelo hayu haminim omrim.
That's in the Hebrew.
What do you mean in the Hebrew? Which Hebrew?
Steinsaltz.
Oh, in Steinsaltz. In the Steinsaltz Hebrew. Because the Steinsaltz is trying to undo the changes made by the censor, the Christian censor. And minim was understood by the censor, Christians and the censor of the Catholic Church, to mean the church. It was most commonly understood that was every time minim came up in the text, they changed it, and they changed it to the Sadducees, which is not minim, not heretics, real heretics, as Christians could be called heretics, but Sadducees, plain old-fashioned Jewish heretics, okay, to make the point. So
what does minim mean?
Heretic. A min is a heretic.
Right. So in order to hide the fact that they were meaning Christians,
they might have meant. Minim was a term that Jews would use or could use in relation to Christians.
So to protect themselves, they turned it into
text. Well, no. The church didn't. The church went over the text of the Talmud.
Right.
And any time it was offended by the text, it changed it. Okay? So that, until the church, of course, finally burned the Talmud. I mean, it was a series of steps. But in a tolerant stage, they just censored the Talmud. When they got less tolerant, they just burned all the books of the Talmud. Okay?
Wasn't the Sadducees just
the down and out? Weren't the Sadducees, my point is that they're irrelevant to this. That was just put in by the censor.
Yeah. But they were okay? All gone by this time.
Oh, what do you mean, by this time? Well, that's a little hard to say. Because Sadducees only make sense in temple times.
Right.
Okay, you have Pharisees and Sadducees. I can't imagine that there wasn't, even after the destruction in 70, there was some spillover. You know, suddenly these groups don't suddenly disappear and their points of view don't suddenly disappear. They're not real players in the game after that, because the only players that we know about are the Pharisees, because they wrote the Talmud. Everybody else disappeared. Not that they really disappeared, but we have no literary evidence of much of they said. Okay.
We learned this before about
this is in the Mishnah itself.
Yes.
Take a look at the Mishnah.
Let's see if we have man created alone.
Correct.
Yeah.
Here we go. Or any of those. All those 37A, 1, 2, 3, it's just repeated in English. Let's see where it says. That the last part is Shaloa Yuaminim Omrim Shtei Rishiyot. Alright, now that's the same point here, but it's said differently. It's the same point, but the Baraita actually develops the idea differently. What in the Mishnah is the source of that? How do we learn that there is not Shtei Rishiyot? It's because there was one human being created. Okay? Because had there been two, then there could have been one for one god, one for the other god. Shtei Rishiyot means two gods. Okay? Here, it's different. Here, the question is, why was the human being created on the last day? Okay? Why was the human being created on the last day? And there, had the human being been created before that, you could have made the argument, that God created with the help of the human being. Okay? Because the human being often conceives of himself as godly, or as the God. Okay? So if a human being is created at the end of the creation, then it's quite clear the human being is not a party to this creation. Okay? So that then is the reason given, having to do with the order of things, which is different from the reason given in the Mishnah, although the bottom line is the same. It's against the notion that there be two gods dualism. And then it goes on, telling us about the order of creation. Now the Baraita, this Baraita is interested in the order of creation. Devaracher, another interpretation. She'im tazuach da'ato alav. If a human being were to be arrogant, proud, if he were to be proud, okay? Omer lo yatush kedamcha b'maseh bereshit. Okay? One can say to him, don't you realize that a mosquito came first in the creation? In other words, if you think you're so good, just remember who came first when God created the world. The mosquitoes came first, all the other things came first. You are an afterthought. You are an afterthought. Okay? So that's a lovely idea here. This is to work against human pride, lest human beings be filled with pride. Okay? Omalo yatushke dam harba maase bereshit, kadeshi yikan v'davar acher. And there's yet another explanation here. Kadeshi yikanes l'mitzvah miyad. So that he be able to enter into a mitzvah immediately. What's the mitzvah?
Shabbat.
Shabbat. Now you mean to say Adam observed the Sabbath? Of course. You don't have to have historical logic here. But the notion is that the very first thing was the Sabbath. Okay? So the first thing that he could do was to observe the Sabbath. Okay? That's a beautiful idea here, even if it's historically not too compelling. Davar acher, another reason. Kidei sheyikanes lasu'udamiyat. That's a little bit more complex. So that he might enter into the banquet right away. Mashal lemelech basar v'dam. This is like the analogy of a king of flesh and blood. Shibana palatrin v'shichlalam v'hitkin sudan. He built a palace and he decorated and he then prepared a banquet. Okay? V'ahar kach hichnis orchim. And only afterwards, after he had built everything and he had prepared the banquet, did he invite the guests. So here it's the sense of the place of the human being in the creation that ultimately God prepares everything for the human creation. So it's not exactly the opposite of what we read just a second ago of the Yatush, of the mosquito being more important than the human being, but it's sort of the opposite. I mean, here the human being is important enough so that God prepares the entire creation. So it could go either way. Right? If people are depressed, tell them the latter part of the story. If people are too proud, you tell them the former part of the story. Right? There are all kinds of people around, and even some of us feel differently at different times. Okay? So there are two different ways to look at it. Any comments there?
You could say that when God created humans, he gave up on creation.
Gave up on creation.
Right, that having seen what he created, that was why he stopped going on. So, of course, that's how you get to be the last.
It's also true. It's funny that the Midrash doesn't say that.
Save the best for last.
Save the best for last. Okay, now, it doesn't actually say that either. That's an interesting thing, because it might have said that. It might really have said that. But so central is what Barry is referring to here, the notion of human sinning in the story, that it doesn't really say that. Although it's implied in this last one that we read, that the banquet is prepared, everything is prepared, finally for the guests to come. So that's a very positive statement nonetheless.
Well, I have a comment. I'm sorry.
Yes, Henry, go first.
The first one here about the name asserting that that they might assert that man was somehow involved in the creation mystifies me for a number of reasons. One, it's hard to believe that man would ever take credit for being a partner in creation to that extent. Number two, I don't understand why the church or the medium or whatever would want to assert that. But there's also a concept, I think, in Judaism that man is the partner in creation in certain respects.
Well, let's look at the first part of what you said first. First of all, keep in mind, when we're talking about the meaning here, we're really not talking about Christians. We're talking about pagans. Okay? We're talking about pagans. And the separation between the pagan God and the world is an interesting thing, but it's not what it is for us, for sure. Human beings in the pagan world may be divine. They may turn into gods. There may be a movement between the realms. Okay, so the human and the divine realm are not so separated. And surely in the pagan myths, we're very aware of that, that the gods are very human, and some of the humans end up being gods. You know, that will be the stories. That's what you're talking about here. You're not talking about Christians. At a much later period of time, the Christians step in and they say, and they're aware of the fact that there are among the Jews those who see them as pagans because they worship an idol. You know, there's something on the cross there. And there's a Trinity, which is very hard in a very disciplined monotheism to have a trinity. Although the church itself is able to explain that, it was hard to explain to many of the Jews, and was hard to explain to the Arabs too when the Muslims came around. Okay, so that's that. As far as a human being being a partner in the divine creation, that's a different idea. Here the issue is not so much creation. The issue is the divinity of the human being. The Shtei Rishiyot is lest we think the human beings are divine. Right? They're not. Let it be said clear for once and for all, the human beings are human, and the God is divine, and that's it. There's no connection between the two. Having said that, we now have two realms, the realm of the divine and the realm of the human. There may, in fact, be a partnership between the divine and the human realms, okay? And that partnership may involve an ongoing kind of creation, but it's not the same as there being two divine creatures. Okay? Good. Very good. Yes, sir.
Is there a concept in Judaism of God creating the process of evolution, as we understand it?
I just read today in a journal published by Bar Ilan University. This was 2 issues ago, and a scholar published an essay, which I didn't read the essay. I just was going through tables of contents to see what journals to read. I do that periodically. So he wrote an essay entitled exactly what you just said. So I don't have the answer yet because I didn't read the article. But I'm very doubtful. Very doubtful.
I'm just going to add that it's my understanding from whatever I've been in contact with, that in Christianity this is an issue, that Jesus is supposed to be divine, and that I think Christianity could be put into the religions that this is countering, because it really is very much part of their theology that you have someone who's both human and divine. Mm-hmm. And so saying that making the separation is also counter to Christianity.
Yep. This, again, I think that this particular baraita is pre-Christian. You know, it's just in terms of its own origin, you're dealing here with a baraita which probably dates from 200 or before, where even though there is a Christianity around, they're not players. And they're not players to be addressed. Once in a while you have some mention of Christianity in the Talmud, but they're really not the players on the field here, as are the pagans. It's a pagan world that Jews are living in.
So my comment was piggybacking off of Henry's last part of the comment, which is, I think that the end with the banquet, it's not that we're partners in creation, but that we're witnesses to the creation. So if somebody prepares this wonderful banquet, but there are no guests to witness it, mm-hmm. then does the banquet really exist, kind of? So on the one hand, we're less than gnats. On the other hand, we're necessary to witness the wonderful creation of God. So in that sense, we would be the bridge.
From the divine perspective, that would be very important, I would think. Because otherwise, for what?
Exactly.
For his own enjoyment?
Exactly.
God already is happy.
Exactly.
He's happy, sad. We don't know anything about God. We can't say. But we have to create the world for that kind of enjoyment.
We have some intimations, like the motzi, right?
Okay.
We talk about, in fact, bread doesn't come from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Bread comes from humans doing something that comes from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So at that level of creation, there is a partnership, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
It's very different than humans making species or something, mm-hmm. but we do recognize.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Rav Sadia Gaon, in his Sefer Emunot V'Deot, Book of Beliefs and Opinions, first great book of medieval Jewish philosophy, written in the 10th century. He wrote Babylonia, written in Arabic. So he makes the following point. He says, when the Torah says that man was created in the image of God, what does it mean? What does it mean to be created in the image of God? You know there are lots of different possibilities here. Asadhyaya says that the image of God means that as God was a creator, man will be a creator. Very good point. It's a very important point. That in the creativity of the human being is manifest the divine image. Because that's really the only thing we know about God. We don't know anything about God in the Torah, except for the fact that God creates. Right? So when it says in our image, Asadhyaya says must refer to that.
I like the idea that when you look at any other human being, because every human being is made in God's image, mm-hmm. you're looking
he reminds
at,
you of
at
God.
A manifestation of God.
Very nice.
And that's why you should be treating people well.
That's also a good one.
don't we also know that God punishes?
Correct.
So, something else.
We could say lots of things. I'm just Barry raised the point, and I'm just sort of answering it. But there are lots of possibilities. Okay, let's go on. Now here, the Gemara simply brings us verses to bolster this last opinion. Chochmot banta veita. Wisdom has built her house. Chatzva amudeha shiv'a. She has hewn out her seven pillars. Tafcha, tifcha, mascha, yena. She has prepared her meat. She has mixed her wine. Af archa shulchana. She has also set her table. Shalcha narata tigra al gape merome karet. She has sent forth her maidens, she calls, on top of the heights of the city. Now you'll see a more explicit explanation of this verse. This is from the Book of Proverbs. It's sort of comprehensible, but in detail, some of the Hebrew words really are hard to understand. Chochmot banta beta, zo midato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This refers to the wisdom, the characteristic wisdom, the nature of God's wisdom, blessed be He. That's to say Chochmah. Chochmah, generally, as the rabbis understand the term Chochmah when used in the Proverbs, it usually refers to the Torah. The Torah is God's Chochmah. That's God's wisdom. So probably that's what it's referred to here. Shabara et kol ha'olam kulo b'chochmah. He created the entire world with wisdom. Now there, again, I don't think what's being referred to here is the notion that that the world is filled with wisdom, but that, number one, divine creation is a wise creation. Okay. It's like El Adon al kol ha-ma'asim. When we say the El Adon in the Shabbat morning service, it's all a wise and a beautiful creation. Okay, so the creation is wise. Also, I think there's another dimension to it here, and I think that it goes back to what I said a moment ago, and that is Chochmah is the Torah. And the Torah is an ideal notion of creation. It's an ideal creation. This is in the Midrash in Bereshit Rabbah, the first parsha. The ideal creation is a Platonic creation. It is a creation of ideas. It is a set of ideas that is substantially different from the actual creation itself. So that when it says that God created b'chokhmah, what it means is that he used the Torah, which is an ideal set of ideas, in order to have a blueprint for the concrete creation which followed it. Okay?
The Torah or the Chochmah is such an important pillar of creation. Why God waited for Moses to give us the Torah? Why didn't give it to Adam?
The Midrash asks the same question. It's a very good question, and there is a point of view that was that he should have gotten the Torah immediately. And the reason that he didn't was what we had said before, because of the sin. Because of sin. God was, you know, when you're really excited about something, and you finish it, everything is great, and then boom, it backfires on you. It takes time to get over that. So it took God time until the generation of Moses.
But he could have ended it by giving it to her before this thing created.
Exactly. First of all, he has to have a human being. He has to have a human being, okay? He could have given it to the animals, but that wasn't appropriate. Okay? And what was unusual about the human being? What made a human being really worthy of the Torah? Free will. Free will. Human being has free will. The Torah is something that the human being learns from and that either has the free will to do or to not to do. So it creates the human being with free will. Right? No sooner does he do that than what? Bingo. He sins. Okay?
But you gave us a reason several months ago in the beginning. You said that we would only be ready for the Torah once we realized how chaotic the world was. So we needed that chaos until Moses.
That's the only way I can answer it.
Oh, but you said that several months ago.
Yeah, but I'm not, we're dealing in Midrash. Midrash is not philosophy.
I see.
See, a philosophy would give you an answer that's true in all circumstances.
I see.
Midrash is only true in limited circumstances. Because that's the only kind of truth that's really true, by the way.
Okay.
The only kind of truth that's true has limited application.
I see.
Okay? And so that I was right then? Right
but there'd be nothing in the Torah, because nothing had happened that would be written. But I'm just saying that what makes the Torah is having the history with the commandments.
So it was meant to work out the way it worked out. The divine wisdom is such that it was bound to happen that way anyway, but we didn't know about it, only God knew about it.
How do we know, one of the footnotes said that Adam sinned the very first day he was created.
Oh, it's coming up. It's coming up. Coming up. It's further down the page.
Earlier part of the right. That Adam was created right before Shabbat meant he could experience Shabbat immediately.
Right.
Wasn't every day Shabbat to him?
Well, they were working.
Every day was a day of rest.
No.
Well, the key thing was, but remember on the first Shabbat, the key one who is resting is not Adam. It's God. It's God. And that, therefore, what you said first was, I really like that. I'll sit on that for a minute. Because you said the first thing he could do is experience the Shabbat. Experience the Shabbat. Okay? So, he didn't know what he was doing, I'm sure. I mean, he's just getting started. You'll see some of the things that the Talmud says happened this first day, and actually a lot happens the first day. But that having been said, comes Shabbat, and it's interesting that what we are learning here is that he experiences it. It's a certain kind of divine tranquility. And it's nice that he learns from the divine tranquility. Okay? When God rests, he comes to understand something really profound in his own life. Okay? I'm sorry.
I get the feeling, or I always interpreted that fact, that God created wisdom to mean that there was only one truth. That truth isn't relative. It's only that wisdom that he created.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good interpretation of that?
Maybe.
Right again.
I think rather Talmudic in my answer. Because the problem, I'll tell you the problem with that. The problem is, who's right? You know, there's only one thing that's right, and it's what I think, right? So the problem is to define what is right. I referred to that a little bit before. Philosophers do that. I was reading this afternoon Thomas Aquinas. It's really something to read the Catholics. Catholics really figure out what's right. They really figure out what's right. In Judaism, it's not that obvious that that's the way we go. None of the philosophers, just think, Maimonides, how often does Maimonides' guide to the perplexed act as the source of what is right? And how often it is? Never. Nothing is based on Maimonides' guide to the perplexed. You can argue on the basis of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his compilation of the law. The law. But we don't have a philosophical religion. It's not essentially, the religion itself is non-philosophical. It allows space for philosophy. Philosophy is natural, but the decision about what is right is not really a philosophical decision. It's a legal decision. And in the law, those of you who are in the law know, the law is, you know what's right and you don't know what's right. There's usually somebody who can argue the other side. And a few years may go by and the other side may be right. So there's a much different sense of certainty when you have a religion that's a religion of law as opposed to a religion of philosophy. Okay? Okay, keep going. We're still going through this. He has hewn out her seven pillars. Elu Shivat Yemei Bereshit. That is referring to the 7 days of the creation. Okay, so this verse that we have here in Proverbs is interpreted in this midrash in the Baraita as referring to the 7 days of creation. Elu Shivat Yemei Bereshit. Tavcha, Tivcha, Mascha, Yena, Af, Archa, Shulchana. She has prepared her meat, she has mixed her wine, she has also set her table. Elu yamimu naharot bechol sorchei olam. These refer to the seas, the rivers, and all the sorchei olam, the necessities, it's not really necessities of the world, all the beautiful things that God created. That's what it's talking about here. You know, all the things that are part of that table, that set table that the Lord created for us. Right, and after that, Shalcha Narata Tikra, she has sent forth her maidens. She calls Ze Adam Lechava. Right, he invites guests to this. Who is it that he invites? Adam Lechava, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are the ultimate guests to the divine creation. Right? Now, here, of course, Adam and Eve are archetypes. That's who we are. Now, we're Adam and Eve. And essentially here you have this, I think this extraordinary idea that human beings are guests at the divine banquet. Okay? That the divine, through the 7 days of creation, through all of the divine efforts to create this creation, ultimately we are guests at that banquet. Christians, the Christian theologians today, have popularized a certain way of talking about it, and they call it stewardship. The human beings have a role of stewardship. We have that also. We have a direct. We have this notion of stewardship because it says after God creates the garden, he puts Adam into the garden, and he says, "Lo'ovda u'le'shomra," right? To till the soil, u'le'shomra, to guard it. To till and to guard. So there's the notion of guarding. But here you have it worked out in rabbinic literature. What is there to guard? Why guard it? Why not just destroy it? Okay? Because the divine is a creation and you are invited to the meal. Okay? You are invited to appreciate everything that was made in that creation. Okay? Moving on. Algape, this phrase in the Proverbs is very unusual. Algape merome karet. On top of the heights of the city. Algape merome karet is like kiryat. Kiryat. Or karta in Aramaic is the city. Rabba barbrachana rame. Ketiv algape, it is written on the top. which indicates that Adam's status was lofty. All right, Al-Gate, Merome, he was at the top. Uchtiv Al-Kisei, just following later on in the Proverbs, it's written upon a seat, Batachila Al-Gate, Ulevasof Al-Kisei. He starts out on the top of the mountain and he ends up on the chair in the bottom of the mountain. Here's where we're beginning now to get to sin. Okay? Adam starts out very lofty. Starts out with tremendous hope, tremendous potential, and doesn't do such a good job of it. So that is the use of this agape, and then later on, in the next verse, it uses the term kisei to say from up there to down here. Okay, going on. Oh, this is continuing in Proverbs. Mi peti asur heina chasar lev analo. Again, Hebrew is hard to understand. So when they have these difficult passages, if it fits a notion that they are seeking to teach, and we could call it a philosophical or a theological notion, they will take the words very much out of probably their context and understand something else from it. Right. Mi pete, you're not going to like this one. Mi pete yasur hena. Whoever is simple, let him turn aside here. He who lacks understanding, she told him. Lev amralo. Amar kadosh baruch hu. Mi pitolaze. Who persuaded this guy Adam to sin? Who persuaded him? Isha amralo. The woman. Said to him, because it says there, mi peti, who is the one lacking understanding? Okay? This is in your edition of the Talmud, we're going to cut this out. Dichtiv no'ef isha chasar lev. Now, it's interesting, the verse that's used in order to understand chasar lev, to refer to a woman, doesn't refer to a woman at all, it refers to a man. Because here it says, no'ef isha, a man who commits adultery with a woman, chasar lev, is a jerk. Okay, is a jerk. So, a chasar lev lacks intelligence. So, it's just by a stretch that it's brought into this comment.
Well, it brings them both into the picture.
Brings them both, man and the woman, into the picture. Yeah, they're both in the same verse. They're both sinners. Correct. That's true. Okay. Next baraita. Tanya. Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir would say, Adam HaRishon Mikol HaOlam Kulo Hutzpar Ofaro. It's a fantastic idea. Rabbi Meir would teach, Adam HaRishon. No, Adam HaRishon means the first man. And that's how Adam is called. In much of the rabbinic literature, he's not called Adam. In English, you call him Adam. In Hebrew, you call him Adam HaRishon. Okay? The first human being. Adam HaRishon, Mikol HaOlam Kulo Hutzbar Oforo. The dirt that was used to create Adam was gathered together from the entire world. That, I think, is a fantastic idea, because lest you say, oh, it came from New York. Adam was a New Yorker, essentially. The bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. You know, we New Yorkers, I remember one of my college roommates was in the Peace Corps. In my time, Peace Corps was a big thing to do after college. So I went to Israel, he went to Kenya. So after I came back from Israel, he came back from Kenya. I went to see him. Lived upstate New York. So I said, well, what was it like to be in Kenya? So he told me stories of living in Kenya in the backwoods, so they would put, and of course, it wasn't really clear what the Peace Corps people were supposed to do. Any of you in the Peace Corps? So it was hard for him to figure out what his job was. And it was a very nice idea. It wasn't entirely practical. So he said he found that one of the best things that he did was that there were some black Americans who had gone to live, they were working for the State Department, I guess, and were living in Kenya. And he said he really felt his most important role was because the children of this family hung out with him, because they went to Kenya figuring that they would be with, you know, they would be in Africa. As Afro-Americans, they would be in Africa. He said the only people they felt comfortable with was this white guy from upstate New York, because they were made from the same dirt, you know. They're out of the same culture. They're made out of the same culture. So here, Rabbi Meir is saying that Adam is a creation of the entire world. Right? We had seen that said before, that there was just one creation, so that you could not say, my father was greater than your father. Okay? This is saying it in a different way. Right? This one creature was made from the essence of the entire world. Okay?
Does that relate also to what we discussed last week with the Jews in Babylonia?
Oh, wait. Hold your breath. you're sensing exactly where the Talmud is going. The Talmud is going exactly there. Okay, so let's just do this first. Adam HaRishon Mikol HaOlam Kulo Hutzpah Rofarau Shenema, as it says, Gomi Ra'u Enecha. This is King David speaking in the Psalms. Your eyes beheld my unshaped form. Uchtiv, and it's also written, Ki Hashem Einav Meshotetot Bechol Haaretz. The Lord's eyes wander over the entire earth. They sweep over the entire earth. Okay? Now, watch what's going to happen next. Amar Rav Hoshaya Mishmei Derav. Rav Hoshaya says, in the name of Rav. Now, Rav Hoshaya is a Babylonian, as is Rav. He's a Babylonian speaking. Okay, Rabbi Meir was a Tana from the land of Israel. Now we're dealing with Babylonian Amoraim, who I think undoubtedly are aware of Rabbi Meir's teachings. Okay? Listen to the way they teach it slightly differently. Adam HaRishon Gufo Mi Bavel. His body comes from Babylonia. V'rosho me Eretz Yisrael. And his head from the land of Israel. The Evarav Misha'ar Ha'aratzot. And his limbs from the other lands. Agvotav. Oh, so then somebody asked the question, or else he's asking the question himself. Agvotav, his buttocks, his behind. Okay, so we now know where the whole place comes. What's the lowliest part of the human being is the buttocks. The buttocks, where are they from? Amarav Acha, mi Akra di Agma. From Akra di Agma. Okay, let's see if we can figure this out. Take a look at the Rashi here. Rashi right up at the top. On the right side of the page, we're 38b1, so look over to the right side. Gufo mi Bavel. Here the Rashi actually spans the whole page. So it actually begins on the right side of the page at the top. Gufo mi Bavel. His body is from Babylonia. Al shem shahayeta amuka nir'e shemisham lukach. Because Babylonia is low, it appears that from there it was taken, the body was taken. Ulechach ma'asa mitzula. And therefore it was made deep. Now, let me translate this as, it's in a very modern English, and some of you may get this English when I translate it. The kind of English that any of you go to the gym, this is the current way of talking about the body. Listen to this. I'll translate it this way. Al Shem Shayeta Amuka. Babylonia was deep. That is to say, the land of Israel, if you travel in the land of Israel, the land of Israel has a lot of mountains in it. It's a mountainous territory. The spine of the land is, it's a spine filled with mountains right up through, starts down in the south, just north of Beersheba, goes right up, and it's a rift valley, the spine of the land of Israel. So Israel is hilly, and the coast is not so hilly, of course, but then you go up a little bit further north to the Carmel. You're in the mountains again. You go up further east, and you're on the Hermon. So it's relatively hilly. Babylonia, never been to Babylonia, but I understand Babylonia, relatively speaking, was low country. It was low country. It was the wide plain of the Tigris and the Euphrates, I guess, or something like that. But it's low country. Shemisham lukach. Now here, guf, the body was taken from Babylonia, the dirt of Babylonia. There, I would translate the body as guf in the modern language as the core. If any of you could go to the gym there, the core exercises are for your what? Your stomach. That's the abs, right? The abdominal exercises are called core. That's what they call core in the up-to-date English today. Shemisham lukach. So the core is illustrative because if it's well-formed, well-shaped, it goes in, as it were. It goes in. And that's the meaning, v'lechach na'asam mitzula. Therefore, it is made deep to go in. Okay? Maybe that's what it means. Maybe that's what it means. Okay? V'rosho me'eretz Yisrael. His head, Adam's head, came from the land of Israel. Still reading in Rashi. Shehi gvoha, he gvoha, it's higher, relatively speaking, it's higher. V'chashuva mikol ha'aratzot. And is more important than any of the other lands. The Evarav yadav v'raglav. His hands and his feet are being referred to by the limbs. Misha'ar ha'aratzot shokol ha'olam shokol mikol ha'olam. So the hands and the feet are from the rest of the world. But specifically, the body from Babylonia and the head from the land of Israel. Now, my reading of this is actually somewhat different. I think what you see here is another reflection of the Babylonian rabbis dealing with who they are and who the rabbis in the land of Israel are. That what surprises me is that Rav says here that the head comes from the land of Israel. That's a little bit of a surprise. I might have thought that he would say the head comes from Babylonia and maybe the goof from the land of Israel. Not having nothing to do with geography, but having to do with culture, having to do with their own sense of hegemony in the intellectual world, and who really is more important, and which group of rabbis is really a determinative group of rabbis. Although maybe here the head is the land of Israel, that the Mishnah comes from the land of Israel. That was edited by Rabbi Judah the Prince. Okay? That was done in the land of Israel. Who are the determinative rabbis for interpreting the Mishnah? Who create the goof of the Talmud, the body of the Talmud? The Babylonian rabbis. The Babylonian rabbis. So, my hunch is here that maybe that's what's going on. And that's what you're seeing reflected here.
But isn't there also this idea that we should strive to be low like the dirt, like the earth, and that way we actually attract more? And that actually the more humble we are, the more lowly we are, actually the closer we are to Hashem. And that's
very
actually
definitely
a positive
so.
Thing.
Very, absolutely, very definitely so. And remember, all of this is dirt. One question is, where's the dirt coming from? So when they, Adam is created from the dirt, right? Min ha'afar,
right.
From the dirt.
Right.
So that's the basis that we're starting with. What they're adding to it is which dirt. The first opinion, Rabbi Meir's opinion, is the dirt of the whole world. All right, the whole world is in his hands. It's all equal.
Right.
Then you have this latter view. It's not all equal.
Okay.
This is better than that. This is better. This, and the way you say it's better than that, head comes from here, body comes from there, and so on. And that's the way you compromise with that otherwise universal idea, which was the idea of Rabbi Meir.
You didn't mention the heart.
Correct. They did not mention the heart. Correct. Only the head and the body are mentioned. Only the head and the body. Which is one of the that would further strengthen my argument, I think. That what is being referred to here is obliquely the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Mishnah and the Gemara. That you're dealing really in metaphoric language here. Because if it were heart, it would be more theological. That's what I would expect. And of course, lev doesn't necessarily mean heart. Lev in the Talmud's Hebrew also means mind. It really means what we would call mind. To them, they were not as focused on the brain, but the brain and the heart were the source of what we call mind.
How do you deal with this? The Agmas apparently in Babylonia.
There are two ways to deal with that. First of all, let's see what Rashi says. Here, read Rashi. Rashi is Akra the Agma, Bavelhu, right? It's a town or an area in Babylonia. Vahu Amok Ma'od. It's very low. I'll tell you what my suspicion is. I have nothing to go on other than my hunches. That it was a disgustingly filthy place. That's what my hunch is. Because I think that to separate out the agavot, only two reasons, I don't know why it would be separated out. I mean, I'm aware in Far Eastern culture, have you ever been to Thailand? If you go to Thailand, you have to be very careful not to shake a person's hand with the wrong hand. Because the Thais will wipe themselves after defecating with one hand and will not use that hand for any interpersonal relationships because it's considered to be lowly. It's a lowly thing. Okay? That's the hand that you wipe yourself with. In certain cultures, that's very, in the Far East, those issues of cleanliness are very basic. They're sort of they manifest themselves in numerous ways in the culture, favoring one side of the body instead of the other side, and all has to do with the functions of excretion in the body. I couldn't tell you.
Sanzio says notorious on account of the loose morals of its inhabitants, and it refers to Ginsberg's legends. Also.
Oh, that's very interesting. that's an interesting comment, because there, that's an interesting, that's a fascinating thought. Because there, it's different from what I just said. I'm talking about elimination. But you could look at it as a sexual image. That, first of all, the view of the rear side of a person is sexually stimulating. Or that it's even agavot may be a euphemism for the sexual organs. And they just wouldn't say that, even though they might mean that. Because you hardly ever say, when you're talking about those things in the Talmud, you never say what you mean. So it's always done euphemistically. So that's a very interesting thought. People were loose there. Good.
India too. You only eat with your right hand for this reason.
Yes. Yeah.
Just pick up food.
Same reason. Same reason.
They're living in Babylon.
Yeah.
Look like Babylonians, but Rabbi Yiddish cup, the head comes from
okay. I'm glad to hear them say it. Right.
Well, the body is from Babylonia, and when they
sit up and try to climb.
Okay. Very good. His head is still toward the end of his room. Anybody else? Let's keep going. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Bar Chanina. Rabbi Yochanan Bar Chanina says, Shteim Esrei Sha'ot Havei Hayom. The day of Adam's creation was 12 hours long. Don't ask me how he knows this. But, I mean, I assume what he is talking about is just that the date that happened in the daytime, okay? Because we know the creation goes on, and then says vayehi erev vayevoker yom shishi. So a lot of things happen before comes the creation of the human being. So the midrash is here that it was 12 hours long. Of course, that would mean, by the way, that the creation took place either in at the vernal equinox or the autumnal equinox, which is also part of the idea here that the creation is in one of those two times. And in rabbinic literature, those are two possibilities. Okay? And we have, by the way, a remnant of it. What do we have in the autumnal equinox? Roughly speaking, we have Rosh Hashanah, right? That new year. And then when do we count which is the first month of the year is from Pesach? Okay? So you have both these points of view in the Talmud. Both of them you'll find in different contexts. So part of that is this notion from the Midrash that the first day when Adam was created was the day was 12 hours long. So it was either the fall or the spring. Sha'ana, look what happens. Here is the sense of everything that happened in the human creation. Sha'arishana hutzbar aparo. During the first hour, Adam's dust was gathered. Shnia ma'aseh golem. During the second hour, it was made into a shapeless mass. Shlishit nimtachu evarav. During the third hour, his limbs were stretched out. Now, nimtachu evarav doesn't mean his limbs, really. It means that the formless golem, that formless form that was there, was shaped into a useful form. Rivi'it nizraka bo neshama. Right, so the human form is in the third hour. The fourth hour, the soul was put into him. Nizraka bo neshama. Chamishit amad al raglav. In the fifth hour, he stood on his feet. Fascinating idea here, that it is the erect nature of the human being that is so crucial. Just your philosophical sense, your evolutionary sense, all should be playing here. Chamishit amad al raglav, shishit kara shemot. During the sixth hour, he named all the animals. Right? He begins to achieve his place in the creation, naming the animals.
Is that like awareness also?
Yes, awareness is part of his being, how can I say it nicely, his mandate to rule over the animals. His mastery over the animals. Shvi'it nizdavgalo chava. During the seventh hour, Eve was paired with him.
What about those 6 hours of creation?
No, she was not there. She was not there until this point.
To create 6 hours in Adam's body.
No, she was created from him. All right, yes. In the seventh hour.
For him, it was 6 hours minimum to create him, and for her, it was like this.
Well, she was created out of him. That's what the Torah says. Shminit. Look what happens in the Shminit. Shminit alula mitah shnayim viyardu arba'ah. In the eighth hour, they went to bed. And they got out of bed as four. And what do you think that means? They conceived the child. They conceived the child. Okay?
But so,
four means two children. Well, how many did they have?
Cain and Abel.
Oh, Cain and Abel. Now, implied here is that Cain and Abel were not only brothers, but twins. But twins. Maybe. I'm not finished with this. I'm going to take you on a little bit of a trip now, and you're going to see some interesting midrash. But this is the sense that all of this is happening. They have sex, okay? There's a conception, and I don't think it means that they have to be born, although, if you look at the English here, it says they were born that day, too. That's ridiculous. They're not to mean that at all. You don't have to be so literal.
Oh, yeah,
when you read
that part.
you're dealing here in metaphor. You're dealing entirely in metaphor. If you take any of this literally, you can't read this. You can't read any of it literally. You're dealing with the sense of unfolding things, and there are issues here that are coming out. There are issues that are coming out. Wait a little bit because I want to sit on some of these issues in a minute. Right? Shvi nizdagalo chava shminit alula mita shnaim yadu arba'a. Chiit nitztav'a shalo lechol min ha'ilan. During the ninth hour, he was commanded that he not eat from the tree. Asirit sarach. During the tenth hour, he sinned. He ate. Achadesre nidon. In the eleventh hour, he was judged. Right? That was the divine judgment. Shtemesre nitrad ba'alachlo. Nitrad literally usually means was trembled, but here the sense is, I think it's correct in the English, he was banished from Eden and went on his way. Shinemar Adam Biakar Bayalin, man does not remain overnight in a state of glory. Alright? That's a verse that is brought here as the proof text from the Psalms. Now, I said to you that I think to read a midrash like this, you have to think metaphorically and think of what is going on. First of all, it's quite extraordinary to me the developmental nature of it. You cannot read the Torah, as I made reference before to this article that was written in the journal in Bar Ilan about whether Kabbalists believe that the creation was 7 days. That was the essence of this article. Was the creation 7 days? Modern Kabbalist, the famous one, was Rav Kook. Rav Kook, who says, anyone who thinks that the 7 days in the Torah were 7 days doesn't know how to read the Torah. Because the Torah doesn't speak that kind of... You have to know, when you read the Torah, you have to know how to read the Torah. And if you are a literalist, you can't read the Torah, you can't read Shakespeare, you can't read any good literature. Okay? You have to know how to read literature in order to comprehend it. Same thing is true here. Here you have a piece of literature. So it's developmental. And it begins with dirt. It moves philosophically. If you read Plato in the Timaeus, the Timaeus of Plato, which is his astronomy and story of the creation, Plato concentrates in the Timaeus on the difference between a creation of ideas and a creation in substance. And what you are reading here is a reflection of that. That, in fact, there is a creation which is a golem. Golem is unformed matter. And in classic Platonic thinking, it's true in Aristotle as well, matter does not necessarily have a form until the form is combined with matter. Okay? You know, in the grossest of examples, I can give you anything. I could take a piece of clay. clay is unformed until the craftsman forms it into a pot. Right? What is a pot? What is a pot?
A vessel.
What is a vessel?
A container.
A container. How do you know that? How do you know it? Because your mind is able to conceive of the notion of container. Okay? Therefore, container is not a real vessel, but the idea of a vessel. Okay? There is a concept of vessel that our mind is able to conceive. And we are able to take that mind concept, that idea, and take a golem, a piece of clay that was nothing, and turn it into a usable vessel. But in truth, the ideas have an eternity to them, a lastingness. I can take that pot and smash it into a million pieces. I have in no way affected the idea of a vessel. Right? The idea of the vessel is totally independent from the actual vessel itself. Right? That's what you have going on here. This is a Platonic idea working out in this midrash. That was all part of the way I think people thought in the Hellenistic world. It's not. I don't know whether it has its source in Plato, or Plato is really on the piggybacking on other thinkers. But this is what's happening here. So there is Shnia. As soon as you have the golem is the unformed matter. Shlishit nimtachu evarav. Right? Then creation, then there's a process of creation. Interestingly enough, the form of the matter is not the soul. The soul is put in afterwards. Very important. Because it's a question, what do we mean by the human soul? Is the human soul the form of the human body? Or by saying that the soul is the form, in Platonic language, that it's a form, that's why people like Maimonides said that the human soul is the mind, and not the body. Not the body. Okay? And that, I think, is also inherent in this distinction, in these gradations that you're seeing here. Okay? There is a formation of the golem into a shape, but that is not identical with the soul. The soul is something different from that.
Rabbi, I follow what you're saying, but would the Talmudic rabbis have read Plato?
Either the answer is yes, which is possible, and I really don't know for sure, because some of it is so like Plato that it's hard to believe they didn't read it. Or, if the answer is no, sometimes you don't have to read Plato in order to know Plato, because it just happens to be the lingua franca of the time in which you're living. This is to be a cultured person in the Hellenistic world, realize that Tanu Rabbanan is coming from sometime in the period of the Mishnah. Okay? Rabbi Judah the prince brags, his maidservant brags that everybody, he had the largest library in Greek. Okay? So they were well conversant with Greek ideas, even though you don't find them articulated as Greek ideas in the Talmud. They're haunting it. They're haunting it.
We discussed before all the body parts and parts of the body come from different parts of the world, dealt from different parts of the world, and at the end we inject the neshama. Where the neshama is coming from?
From God. The neshama is coming from Elohim. You're going to ask me how? What?
No, but there should be some kind of position of creation of neshama to be mentioned, like all the other things that now God put into, inject into the body.
That's a mystery we've never been able to solve. What is the human soul? Okay? If you could, well, it was created before Shabbat. We see it's created here on this Yom Shishi. This is before the Shabbat. These are the hours of the sixth day. The hours of daylight on the sixth day. So all of this now is the unfolding of the final perfection of the creation before the resting of the divine.
So So they left before Shabbat?
What do you mean by left?
Well, you that's
what this Midrash says. That's a very interesting thing. It's very interesting. This Midrash clearly is saying that they left before the Sabbath. They celebrated Shabbat, but not in the Garden of Eden. So that the Shabbat was then the closest you can come to the Garden of Eden once you have been banished out of paradise. The ideal of human existence, which is never achievable, is closest achievable in the Sabbath. But even Adam was no longer in paradise when he celebrated the Sabbath. Right? The divine revealed itself to him on that Sabbath when he was outside of paradise already. It's a fascinating idea. If the Lord is good to me and I have a chance to write my theological anthropology, it's going to be based on this Midrash.
Wow.
Based on this Midrash, because this is the unification, I think, of both the biblical ideas and the philosophical. But wait, we're getting to the best yet. Hold on. Wait with this, because I've got to get to the next one. Then we'll reflect. Shishit kara shemot, the sixth hour, man has, as we said before, his place with the animals. He begins to name the animals. His mastery, he's above the animals. Shvi'it nishtavka lo chava. In the seventh hour, and it's wonderful that it's the seventh hour too, because what is the hour? What is the number of perfection in the Bible?
Seven.
Okay, so the seven is your perfect number in the Bible. So, in a day which doesn't lend itself in a way to that, finally, on the seventh hour, is the creation of Eve. Right? And it's not just her creation, because it doesn't really talk about her creation here, but their pairing, their being together. Right? That's the seventh hour. Shminit, alula mitashnayim, right? Eighth, two go into the bed, and four come down. Four leave the bed. Right? So in other words, after the man and the woman meet, there is a sexual relation. Then is this progress of sin and ultimately punishment. Okay, and they're banished from the Garden of Eden. All that now in the very beginning. Now, the key thing to note here is when the sex happens. The sex happens before the sin. Sex happens before the sin. I cannot emphasize how significant that is in the history of Western thought. Because just read the entire tradition of the history of Western ideas about the body, its functions, and particularly sexuality. Sex is a part, either is sin or it's a part of sin, because it is part of the body and it is a bodily need, and it is the soul that is above sin, and therefore the body has control over the soul, causes sin. This is a totally different reading of what I call theological anthropology here. The notion of the human being and the relation of the human being to sin and the body is completely different here. Completely different. In fact, the body is made way ahead of all of this. There's no indication there's anything wrong with the body. And the sexual relation happens before that. The relationship between the two in this perfect hour of the seventh hour happens even before the sex. Then comes the sex. Then there is a commandment and human free will and all of that. It's a completely different reading of the relation of sin to the human sexual nature. The sin comes into the picture having nothing particularly to do with sex per se. Sin enters having to do with free will. Free will is the human challenge and the stumbling block to human existence. God creates the human being with free will. He has given the human being a commandment. Right? That's what it says here. He's given a commandment. Only way you can have a commandment is if you can either do what it says or you don't do what it says. Okay? So that's the divine sense that it is in free will that his interest in the human creation is manifest. And of course the human being sins. But all of that has nothing to do with the sexual relations between the man and the woman. It has nothing to do with their personal relations. It is separate from that. And that is why I think it's just so important to realize the vast difference between our tradition and the Christian tradition, which to this day, so much of what continues to go on in our own society about these issues really all goes back to the Christian notions of sin and sexuality. Ours are just completely different. I mean, it's not to say that free sex is what we're talking about here. I'm not saying that at all. But just sinning is its own issue. It will have its relevance to all areas of human life without any doubt. And certainly once we get the commandments, here we have one commandment. He was given one commandment, right? Flunked the test. That's a one-question test. It's a very easy answer. Flunked. Okay, it's over. Okay? Carol, you had to...
So, is soul defined anywhere, or where is the soul, the idea of the soul defined?
In the Talmud, it is never defined.
And where is it?
It's defined in later Jewish literature. The soul is defined. And of course, because it's not in the Talmud, and because in later Jewish literature, when it is defined, it's defined in numerous ways. Therefore, you could say we have no idea of what it means, or it means all of these things, or whichever one you choose it to mean. Best article that I like to think is written on this subject, I wrote. It's published in a Wolf Kellman Jubilee volume, which is somewhere here, somewhere in this library. Rabbi Wolf Kellman, when he retired as Executive Vice President of the Rabbinical Assembly, made a festschrift in his honor. So I contributed an article there on two ideas of the soul in medieval Jewish thought. The idea in Maimonides and the idea in everybody else but Maimonides, in particular Bach and Pakuda. And it's a medieval notion of the soul. But it's a medieval notion of the soul which is based on Aristotle and Plato. Two ideas, because take it from me, if you're going to ask questions like what is the soul, if you read Aristotle and Plato, you've read everything that can be said. Everything is said over again in different ways. But Aristotle and Plato basically say everything that can be said on that subject. And basically, there are two notions of the soul. I'll describe it to you in shorthand. One is the Platonic idea of the soul, that the soul is placed in a body. So that in later Jewish literature, medieval Jewish literature, for example, there is this idea that you have a body and you have a soul, and the two of them are put together, and it's as if the soul almost occupies a space called the body. Okay? It's the spiritual side of the physical body. Now, I don't know whether that's at all satisfied what I just said. I'm not sure that it is, but that's the Platonic idea. Then there's the Aristotelian idea. Aristotle says the following. The soul is the activity of the body. He gives you the following example. There is an axe, cut down a tree. Aristotle says the axe has a soul. The soul of the axe is cutting. The activity of the axe. The eye has a soul. The soul of the eye is seeing.
Is it function or
Yes, it's a function. It's a function.
Like your other idea of the vessel holding something and that existing beyond.
Okay.
Non-humans have an inanimate object.
So Aristotle is saying, and this is in his long essay, De Anima, that on the soul, that the soul is the activity of the thing. There are many things with many souls, but when you and I use the term soul, we generally don't mean that. Rather, we are borrowing from this notion to talk about the human being. Therefore, the question that you really mean is, what is the human soul? Okay? What is the human soul? Since I've already defined it in Aristotelian terms as the activity that is peculiar to that thing, we have to now answer the question, what is the human soul? What is the activity peculiar to the human being and unique, therefore, to the human being? It is the rational soul. Okay? It is rational thinking. Rational thinking. That's Aristotle's answer. That's Maimonides' answer. Maimonides goes exactly according to that. So what I did in the article was to contrast these two ideas of the soul. So I think they're really two different ideas
like
of the soul.
The Aristotelian idea that the soul is not independent of the object.
Correct.
It's like inherent in the object.
Correct. That's why in Plato has this idea that on death, the soul leaves the body. And it goes somewhere. It goes somewhere. The soul actually goes somewhere. And it goes through a series of peregrinations. It goes up to its divine place, because it originally was a part of God. And it comes down in order to be with a human being. And if it achieves perfection, it stays with God when it goes back. And if it hasn't achieved perfection, you know what happens? It falls down to earth again because it has another chance.
The Buddhists
say that. The Platonists say that. The Kabbalists say that. In Judaism, medieval Kabbalism says the same thing. A little bit different because the language is somewhat different. But all of these ideas go back to the distinctions created by Plato and Aristotle. Okay? So, it's a long answer to a short question. Yes, sir.
When you talk about the commandment and its relationship to free will, that it's inherent in having a commandment that there's free will. That's interesting. But if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, I don't know whether we would know that we have free will. You might say, well, they were told to do something.
That's the same. I'll go further with your argument. It's a good argument. It's the same argument as you can never be happy unless you're sad. Right? So why am I sad so much? So you can be happy, because otherwise you'd have no idea what it is to be happy, right?
You're being shown how to be happy.
Correct. Correct. You're right. You're right. You're right.
Then you wonder why they have to be punished. I mean, it's a good thing that we know we have free will.
All of that is...
You waited a couple of hours.
That's awesome.
This reminds me of the story of Cain and Abel that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. That at the end, the person who gets the conversation with God is actually Cain. And even though Cain fails the test, but God says beforehand, he says, if you will improve, you will be upheld, you will be held. So, actually, if you sit with the disappointment instead of pushing it off and falling, then you can actually be held. You can actually stay up. But the minute that you push it off onto someone else, the minute that you ground it in anger or envy or some kind of human earthly emotion, that's when you fall.
Okay.
But it's that choice. It's that free will. It's that option.
Uh-huh.
So the option is actually the point. It seems like the whole creation of Adam here ultimately is to get to the fall. We need the fall. You're saying we need the fall in order to be able to be shown the way and the opportunity and the option how to come back up. That's the whole point. Without the fall, there wouldn't be any... No?
Okay. To be continued.
That's not...
That's